The establishment gets kicked to the curb as both Florida Democrats and Republicans nominate maverick candidates for governor. The battle for Florida's soul is on, and what do you think about that? Join us here this morning as we are live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and thanks for listening. We are always live at 9. Also, make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. And just ahead, we recap last night's dramatic primary victories. Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum shocking the political world as he is the Democratic nominee, and Congressman Ron DeSantis for the Republicans in the race to become the next governor of Florida. Who will get your vote and what are your questions? Give us a call, 549-2937. Then later, former naval officers here on the First Coast share their memories of the late Senator John McCain. Also, we'll tell you why the city's recycling program is costing way too much money and what can be done about that. That's in our Going Green this morning. All of that ahead. But first this hour, a stunning upset in the race for Florida governor last night shocked the political world. Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum, who never led in polls or fundraising, came from behind in a dramatic 11th-hour surge to best the favorite candidate, Gwen Graham, and become the Democratic nominee for Florida governor. Gillum making history as the first African-American nominee to lead the state from a major party. Last night, Gillum told CNN that his fresh and new message to the public and the hard work of his supporters is what drove his campaign to victory.
I think my opponents collectively spent $90 million to our six in this race. And, you know, we just kept, my wife refers to me as Seabiscuit. You know, we sort of were counted out at many points. People thought we would not make it, but we kept going slow and steady, retailing our way all across the state of Florida, a state of 20 million people. People didn't think we had a chance, but we did.
Gillum will face Congressman Ron DeSantis on the Republican side. He upended establishment favorite Agriculture Commissioner Adam Putnam, easily winning the GOP primary. DeSantis thanked his supporters but sent his biggest thanks to President Donald Trump.
I'm not always the most popular guy in D.C., but I did have support from someone in Washington. If you walk down Pennsylvania Avenue, he lives in the White House with the pillars in front of it. And I was able to talk to the president. I want to thank him for his support. I want to thank him for entrusting me with viewing me as somebody who could be a great leader for Florida. So thank you, Mr. President.
As he conceded, Putnam thanked his supporters, too, some who had been working on his campaign for a year.
You've thrown incredible events all over Florida in some of the most amazing places. You have knocked on doors, 400,000 of them in our state. You have put the roots in a grassroots campaign. We ran an honest-to-goodness, genuine grassroots campaign, and I'm really proud of that.
What a night in Florida politics. You always can be surprised by what happens in this state. A.G. Gankarski, reporter for Florida Politics, is here now to break down last night's exciting results. A.G., good to see you as always.
Good to see you.
And give us a call with your thoughts about the race for Florida governor. It's now Andrew Gillum versus Ron DeSantis. Give us a call at 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And let us know your thoughts on our Facebook page. Lots of chatter already there. A lively discussion. Okay. DeSantis was expected to win. We'll talk about him in just a moment. But the big political story of last night, not only in Florida, but really all over the country watching this, was Andrew Gillum's dramatic and surprise victory over Gwen Graham. His supporters had been saying for a few weeks that it was going to happen, that he was surging. Last night, those predictions proved out. And so Gillum shocking the world with this win. AG, the son of a bus driver, no big money, never leading in the polls. He is now the face of the Democratic Party in Florida.
Yes, and arguably nationally at this point, and that's kind of ironic given that the polls never saw him coming. There's one poll he led in early. One poll he led in toward the end, but it was an internal poll. People dismissed it. Thing with Gillum is Gillum brought in a lot of unlikely voters, similar to what Donald Trump did in 2016. A lot of first-time voters, a lot of people who'd lapsed in their voting, people who weren't going to turn out for any of the other candidates. He was able to message. He had money from George Soros and Tom Steyer, the billionaires that like to play in left-wing politics. Bernie Sanders came into the state for him. I saw him last week, and he looked like a winning candidate. He got here on a bus tour, and he was mobbed as he got off the bus. This does not happen to primary candidates. And, you know, what that told me was there was something special there. It looked like it was going to be a photo finish, but, you know, the cities came out. Duval came out over 50% for Gillum, and Graham invested a lot of resources here, a lot of endorsements here, and this happened in city after city across the state. Andrew Gillum is a formidable challenge despite any scandals he may have because, you know, he changes the map for Republicans and Democrats.
It's 549-2937 to join us. And you mentioned an FBI investigation focused on the city of Tallahassee. It does not target Mayor Gillum directly, but certainly that will come up now in the general election campaign. Let's talk about the way forward now for these two candidates who are really, I think, perfect expressions of their parties. On the right, you have Ron DeSantis, who has tied his fortunes to President Trump, has received the support of President Trump throughout his primary race. He is a full spectrum conservative. On the left, you have Andrew Gillum, probably the most progressive candidate to ever be a major party nominee for governor in Florida, and the first African-American to boot. And so which vision for the state's future will win out? This will be a fascinating contest, AG, to watch in the next several months.
Yeah, we know the Republican strategy. They're going to talk about the corruption they're going to allege in Gillum City Hall. They're going to bring out every bit of dumpster diving oppo there could be on him, on his team, on his family, on Chris Chestnut, his best friend who is a lawyer with his own legal troubles. That is going to be the Republican playbook. On the Democratic side, you're going to get a lot of help from pop culture people like Rick Ross and P. Diddy. The rappers endorse Gillum, Charlamagne the God, people like that. You know Barack Obama is going to be in state at some point because, you know, he wants to throw a punch at the Trump machine, and this is a way to do it. Knock out Donald Trump's chosen candidate and paint a way forward for the Democrats in 2020. It's going to be interesting. I think Gillum nationalizes the race in a way, and I'm thinking that nationalization is going to help to overcome the oppo that's going to be shopped to the conservative press by DeSantis and his various operatives.
And it's interesting to look at the turnout numbers from last night as compared to 4 years ago. Both the Democrats and the Republicans, under a million votes total. Last night, 1.5 million Democratic votes, 1.6 million Republican votes. Turnout way up. Trump voters did not stay home. Democratic voters did not stay home. And so it'll be in the fall, as you said, can Andrew Gillum rebuild that Obama coalition in Florida that turned out so handsomely for Barack Obama in this state twice? Can Ron DeSantis really excite and energize Republicans and Trump supporters in Florida, particularly older voters, suburban and exurban voters, and drive turnout for his candidacy? This is going to be one for the books to watch.
Yeah, I mean, the Trump administration feels like the fourth act of a Shakespearean tragedy and has for a while now. And, you know, that's sort of the legacy that Ron DeSantis is going to be yoked to. Whatever Trump tweets on a given day, DeSantis is going to have to answer for that, and so on. I think the NPAs are going to look at the choice between the two. And by and large, you'll see a break toward Gillum. Because, you know, which vision of the state have we seen before? We've seen the Ron DeSantis vision of the state before. We see the lobbied up interest in Tallahassee. You know, we see how the pollution is. We see what happens to Amendment 1 and Amendment 2 and every citizen initiative. And, you know, Andrew Gillum represents a paradigm shift.
And this came up in the campaign, particularly with Gwen Graham, who lost last night. But her big talking point was, 20 years of Republican rule in Tallahassee, isn't it time for a change? Can independents swing on to that message?
I think ultimately that is the bet. Do you think that, not you personally, but is the voter going to think that the Donald Trump administration is something we need to see here in Florida? Rick Scott's been a partner with Donald Trump in the White House for 2 years. What has it really done for the state? You know, those are going to be the questions that people are going to ask. And it's going to be the questions that, you know, this race and really, you know, the down ballot also is going to be predicated on, you know, which vision is more compelling. And if you get those first time voters in there, they're not voting for Donald Trump part two.
Let's talk about some of the big issues in Florida, too, and how they'll factor in the race. Everything from the algae mess, particularly in South Florida, to the debate over gun safety and the Stand Your Ground law and health care. Those are all issues that will come up, I think, again and again in this race. And the state's economy, job creation, growth. These are all issues on which these two candidates could not be farther apart, with the possible exception of how to deal with the algae bloom mess.
Right. And that's just because DeSantis wasn't getting sugar money early enough.
Right.
I have a feeling they're going to work something out very quietly behind the scenes.
You mean a donation to him that is not reported?
No. They'll figure out a way to work donations. They'll figure out a way to work through third-party PACs. I mean, the sugar industry will choose the lesser of two evils for itself. But I look at this as sort of like the Florida Project election. You know, we've been advertising economic prosperity for 8 years, yet you have a subset of people who cannot afford to live. They're having to live in motels. They're having to double up, triple up in rental apartments. You try renting a place here on $8.25 an hour, you're going to be living with somebody making tough choices. This is the same in city after city around the state. You know, I think ultimately these pocketbook issues and the increasing gap between rich and poor, the erosion of the middle class, and, you know, the concomitant expansion of the police state at the same time, all of this militates well for Gillum. And it's something that DeSantis, who is still getting briefed on state issues, mind you, who still doesn't know these local markets, is something Adam Putnam brought out. DeSantis is going to have to find a way to defend what he doesn't even know.
Yeah, that didn't work for Putnam, unfortunately for him, that knock on DeSantis that, look, he's a D.C. creature. He doesn't know this state. That will be one to watch in the general as well. Lots of calls on this at 549-2937. Laplace is in Atlantic Beach. Laplace, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Melissa. Sorry about that. I was out of it.
That's all right. Go ahead. Go ahead.
But listen, I just want to thank you for putting Gillum on. What was it, a couple of months ago?
Yeah, we've had almost all of the candidates on. Everyone except Congressman DeSantis, I believe, has appeared on these airwaves talking about their campaigns. Yeah.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Well, when I heard him the first time, I had never heard him before. And when I heard him, I was just so impressed. And I text my daughter who lives in Loma Linda, California, and I said, Jewel, this is the next governor of Florida. So I will continue to follow what is going on, but I was really impressed and excited. I want to thank you, though.
Well, thank you. Yes, and Andrew Gillum, almost all of the Democratic candidates and one of the Republican candidates, Putnam, have appeared here on 89.9. Of course, as we move ahead to the general election, we will issue invitations to the candidates to come back and talk about their campaigns and the big issues. And as we continue with A.G. Gankarski of Florida Politics, it's 549-2937 to join us. It wouldn't be a political segment if A.G. didn't use the word concomitant. You know it's good when that word comes out, right?
You know I haven't slept when that word comes out.
All right, before we go back to the callers, let's talk about a few of the other races. Al Lawson, as expected, defeated Alvin Brown to win re-election to his seat in Congress. And on the state representative front, Kimberly Daniels in District 14 beat former school board chair Paula Wright.
Yeah, and it's interesting you lump these races together because Duval Democrats seem to want different outcomes in both of them. Duval Democratic Chair Lisa King was an Alvin Brown supporter. You know, Alvin Brown got 60% in Duval County. You know, Lawson had a lot of help from other places, including Representative Tracy Davis, Florida Times Union, police and fire unions, Lenny Curry's a political team. You know, they all kind of helped Alvin lose. And in the Daniels-Wright race, And that was a 10-point Daniels win. And this was with the entire Democratic Party basically saying, we want Paula Wright. Well, too bad. It was an open election. Republicans went to Daniels. There were Republican committees messaging in that one. And Kim Daniels, you cannot knock her out. She has beaten two strong candidates in two consecutive years. And I don't know who they bring up against her for a third act.
And speaking of Lisa King, she was expressing frustration last night about the ballot issues in Duval County. Some ballots not fitting the machines.
The election was so big, they made the ballots too big.
What on earth happened there?
Luckily, they budgeted for scissors, right?
Exactly. Some people literally had to cut their ballots to fit.
Yes, and this raises competency issues at the Supervisor of Elections office. Supervisor of Elections blames it on a different contractor and says the sample ballots were all right. It seems to have affected NPA voters a lot. Also, some Republicans got to me and said that their ballots were not correct in terms of fitting in. They were worried they're going to be provisional and so on. This is a real optics issue, and you have to wonder, does Mike Hogan get a challenge in 2019? Right now, there's no Democrat filed. Does that change? I mean, Tracy Davis worked at SOE. Garrett Dennis worked at SOE.
Would they necessarily file? And speaking of another interesting local race for Duval County Tax Collector, Democrat Mia Jones got a lot of votes last night. She will go to a runoff against Jim Overton, who narrowly edged out his fellow Republican, Lake Ray.
This is going to be a tough one for Mia Jones. I think she capped out at 47% of the vote, really, because the Republicans are going to go in behind Overton. Overton, of the three Republicans, is probably the most moderate. He's probably the one who is more his own man. I think the mayor's people wanted Doyle Carter. Lake Ray is independent in his own right. But, Jim Overton is going to be somebody that, they're going to have to deal with. And it's, these constitutional offices where old politicians go to enjoy their golden years, so to speak, in the political game. And I think Jim Overton is going to be your next one.
Let's go to Thomas on the west side. Hi, Thomas. Thanks for holding. Good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to say I was very disappointed with some of the front runners that didn't want to have anything to do with the media, specifically DeSantis and Lawson, who just wanted to duck all questions. I will never support a candidate that doesn't want to give me the ability to make an informed decision about who to vote for. So I hope in the future they will be more forthcoming.
Thanks, Thomas. Okay. Al Lawson has done this show, I can say, but not leading up to the election. Congressman DeSantis largely stuck to one media outlet, Fox News.
Well, largely, but I mean, I talked to DeSantis.
You've interviewed
a bunch
him.
In this campaign. I talked to Lawson a bunch in this campaign. I can't speak for every outlet's accessibility to these candidates, but I found that when, they had questions, they answered them. You might not like DeSantis' manner. He's a bit brusque and a bit, sneering. But he answered the questions. And Lawson the same way. It's like Lawson was very upfront about the challenges that Alvin Brown presented in the race. And he ran a very active campaign, a lot of media opportunities. So I kind of reject those contentions.
Emily in Riverside is on with us. Hi, Emily. Good morning to you. Go ahead.
Good morning. How are you?
Okay, thanks. Go ahead.
So I just wanted to make this comment. My husband and I vote by mail ballot. And that way we literally sit with a ballot and our laptops and we discuss and compare. And we were following Philip Levine and we voted for Philip Levine. And we kind of feel like we wish that we had waited a little longer and voted yesterday because we didn't have Andrew Gillum enough on our radar. We didn't really know enough about him. And so we're not disappointed. We did our backup research and it's been a most interesting election this year.
Certainly has. Never a dull moment, Emily. And we're getting lots of tweets and Facebook comments about this race. Just a couple here for you. On Twitter, here's one from Jim. It's time for a change in Florida, and I hope Gillum does it. Tune in, turn on, and turn out to vote for Gillum. I'm not old enough to have hung out with Timothy Leary, but I know what you're talking about there, Jim. Okay, and then on our Facebook page, a few comments. Laura, can't wait for November, the blue wave with Gillum surfing the crest. Here's another comment from Deborah. Gillum will raise taxes and create more crime. Why would anyone vote for a socialist? Gillum will...
Is that Donald Trump in disguise there?
And emails from others saying the Democrats will have a problem attracting Hispanics in Florida to vote for a socialist. We will see that charge leveled at Mr. Gillum, that he is going to turn Florida into a socialist style state. So what about that?
It's ironic because we already have crony socialism. I mean, if you look at financial incentives, if you look at the deals that the lobbies have, we already have socialism, but for the corporate class. I think that's one counter that could be made. Gillum has struggled with questions regarding being a socialist or capitalist. We saw it in the Jacksonville forum with the candidates. That was a big talking point. And that's something that's going to haunt him. Is it going to matter? Is it just rhetoric? I mean, that's the thing. Unfettered capitalism has not been the friend of a lot of people in the state. And regarding Hispanics, Gillum won in South Florida. That was Levine country. Levine was supposed to be racking up the margins according to every poll. And that wasn't just African-American votes. That was the Hispanic vote. When you expand the universe and get younger voters engaged, which seems to be happening, when you get people engaged in progressive ideas, it creates a different messaging. And Barack Obama 10 years ago was called a socialist. He was, you know, hit with Reverend Wright and all of these other things. And in the end, it did not matter. And that was 10 years ago. And, you know, Ron DeSantis is not much different from a 2008 Tea Party Republican. He came of age, like, you know, last decade, Tea Party wave. He was one of those guys. So we're going to see. It's going to be interesting to see how, if the DeSantis vision of the world prevails with swing voters who have, you know, don't really have any reason to subscribe to it.
It will be one to watch. It will be one for the ages, and we'll be here for every bit of it. Thanks so much, A.G. Gankarski of Florida Politics, breaking down last night's dramatic primary. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Much more still ahead. Up next, local Navy veterans remember their time with the late John McCain after this. Welcome back. Well, the body of John McCain, who endured 5.5 years as a prisoner of war in Vietnam and went on to become a lion of the U.S. Senate and a 2-time Republican candidate for president, his body will lie in state today in the Arizona State Capitol. This will kick off 5 days of tributes in both Phoenix and Washington for McCain, who died Saturday at his ranch in Arizona from brain cancer. He was 81. McCain was a singular figure in American political life, and tributes to his legacy continue to pour in from around the world and here on the First Coast. Former naval aviators who served with McCain right here in Jacksonville are sharing their memories as well. One of them is Commander Gordon Law, U.S. Navy retired. He joins us now with his reflections on his friend and former colleague, Senator John McCain. Commander Law, good to see you.
Nice. I'm really happy to be here.
And you have some vivid memories of your time with John McCain when you were both assigned to NAS Cecil Field in the 70s. Isn't that right?
That's correct.
Tell us about it.
You know, if anything, John was colorful.
You're right. He was known for that.
Yeah. John had taken over as executive officer of Attack Squadron 174, which was a bonus command. John had not had the time to go through the normal command structures, so he was at a little bit of a disadvantage. I joined from two cruisers in the Med with another attack squadron and met John in his office, and he said, you know, welcome aboard, everything, the standard chat, and he said, I'm going to make you assistant ops, which is a really good air operations, and you know, you're flying more. And I said,
so you were upset you didn't want it?
I didn't want it.
Why not?
I'd already done that. I'd been ops boss on the last squadron, and I said I wanted the maintenance squadron. And he laughed and said, you're insane. Okay, you got it. And that's where we started. It was interesting because it said it was a bonus command. Normally, you would have had another command before you got there. So John was at a disadvantage in that he, because of the POW time, had missed all of the other command structures in between. So this was, for him, a huge learning curve. And for a lot of folks, kind of looking cross-eyed is, you know, that this is a big jump.
Wow. So this was in, this started in what, 1976? He had just come back from Vietnam not long before.
73, I think, he came back from camp. And I think he was, I don't think he was doing much except recuperating.
Sure.
During that time. I don't actually know what transpired between 73 and the time he got there. John, I think, got to 174 in early 2006. I was about midstream in there. So he was about halfway through his executive officer time.
The Navy in the 70s in this town, take us back to that era when McCain was here and working and enjoying life, all young guys in the Navy. It was a different time then.
And there were a bunch of us that were happy we were still alive.
He's still alive, right.
And there was a lot of things going on about, okay, the war's over. What are we doing now? How are we going to change what we've been doing for the last 8 years or so? And there was a lot of humor, fun. Prior to my going other places in 73, when the POWs came back, I was one of the escorts for some of them to try to help them get back in. And that was really interesting. None of them, as far as I know to this day, none of them ever discussed their time in camp. It was just something that they had decided that was not going to happen.
And you didn't ask?
Didn't ask. Already told, don't ask.
Wow.
And so we went on back to trying to see what living is like. And I won't say there weren't any parties going on or any of the other stuff, but it was an interesting time.
I'm sure there might have been some. And you have some incredible memories of McCain just as a commanding officer. What stands out in your memory?
Well, as I said, John was in a bit of a learning curve, but he was certainly not shy. And he's definitely unpredictable, and he definitely had a temper.
So that's what types of incidents do you remember?
I guess one of the fun ones was we had a bunch of young enlisted women show up, and that was unusual at the time. And so John was still like so, and he held a meeting of the department heads, the six or seven of us, and he said, what are we going to do with these folks? And got around to me as the last guy standing, and I said, same thing we do with them. If they were men, we'll make them plane captains. And my master chief and six other people threw stuff at me.
Really? And they didn't want the women to be captains?
And John looked over and said, good plan. That's what we're doing.
That's good.
So we now had a bunch of young ladies that were actually going through all the same things that the guys would do. And getting out to the aircraft with them there was colorful because a couple of times I had to get down on my knees so that they could stand up and get down in and check everything that they needed to check. It was all great, and they all did great.
We're talking with Commander Gordon Law, U.S. Navy retired, about his memories at Cecil Field in the 70s with the late John McCain. If you served with McCain in Jacksonville, you should call us up too at 549-2937. So that time passes. McCain goes on to run for Congress, then Senate. Years and years go by, and then you reconnected with now Senator McCain many years later.
Didn't know John that well then. Excuse me. There were a couple of anecdotes. If I can back up for just a minute, there's a couple I'd like to throw at you that
sure.
were fun. John was in his office, and I was standing outside waiting to go in. The phone rang, and he gets this big smile on his face and says, "Duke, how are you?" And it was John Wayne.
John Wayne.
Yeah, he got phone calls from everybody. It was colorful. This is right after he took command.
And this was due to his status as a prisoner of war, coming home, and everything involved with that, right?
That, and I think family.
And his family.
And the family.
Because he had come from a long line of Navy admirals and servicemen.
Yeah. His father, his grandfather was a four-star admiral. His father was a four-star admiral. And when we had the change of command, when John left to go on to the other things, his father, famously known as fire-breathing Admiral McCain, was there. He was not a tall, whatever structured. He was limping a little bit on a cane. Big cigar in his mouth, and he looked up at me, and those eyes took one look, and I thought, oh, boy.
You're in for it now.
Yeah.
What else do you remember before we move ahead to the more modern era?
I think the only other really, well, there was a lot of humor we did. John was trying to get an outside line for a priority call, and back then we had operators on the phones. It was, believe it or not. And he was cussing and upset and mad and his usual, and he couldn't get a phone line. And I said, "Hey, Skipper, give me the phone." And I picked up the phone and called the operator and said, "Hey, this is Gordy. Skipper needs a line here." And how did you do that? I'm the boss. I said, in my youth, whenever I would leave the bachelor officer's quarters to go out and party, I would call the operators and ask them what they were drinking.
You catch more flies with honey than
friends,
vinegar.
I had friends in high places.
Yeah.
But anyway, go ahead.
And I guess that's one lesson perhaps he never quite learned. He was known for his temper and his vinegary personality as he went on into the Senate. But at the same time, he became beloved. And so when you reflect on his legacy in politics, what comes to mind for you?
The changes. Learned, I think, from this command structure. He had not had that before. And he began to understand, I think, responsibilities in a different way. He struggled through a number of things right after he left, and I think he was Senator Hart's executive assistant for a while, and then he left. He seemed to change a lot when he got into the Senate. At first, he was very quiet. He listened and paid a lot of attention. And I don't think that lasted but a year or so. And from that point on, John became John that we all know him now. He was everywhere.
Were you surprised, having known him from so far back, that he ascended to this political height?
Yes, I think he realized that he was not going to go on up to Admiral of the Navy, that he wouldn't have enough background. And this was something that really caught his attention. I mean, it was, after all, lots of publicity, lots of being there and whatever, but he actually took it very seriously. And that's why I say he was quiet. To my knowledge, he was quiet. I did not have a lot of contact with John when he was actually a senator until much later, which I'll give you a quickie on that one in a little bit. I did follow him. He attended a lot of different events. The tailhook, with the infamous tailhook that the Navy had.
The tailhook convention.
Tailhook
convention.
Sexual
assault took place at that, yeah.
And by the time he got there, I think it was 2011 or 2012 was the one I remember most. And he actually wrote an outstanding speech for that one, probably the best thing he ever did. And that's available online, I think, for people who would like to see how he really felt about a lot of things at that point. And he was then the John McCain we know now, today. I ran into him the last time. I was working for a government contracting group and was in Afghanistan on counter-narcotics programs and having breakfast, and the guy next to me said, hey, this guy McCain's coming in, and we're going to fly him over. And I said, I'm going to go meet him. You can't get on the plane. You know, his security guard won't let you. And I said, watch. Anyway, got on the plane, and it was the 4th of July. We flew John over to another major military airfield, and he got on other planes and flew out all over Afghanistan to visit the troops on the 4th of July. And that was the last time I saw him.
He was known for that. Did that over and over again.
Over and over again.
And so that was the last time you saw him. What did you talk about on that trip, if anything?
We didn't have a lot. When he came aboard, he looked at me, and we hadn't seen each other in years. And I'm a lot older than I was then. And as we were moving, he kind of slid over and said, who are you? And I said, hey, Skipper, you know, you and I are the last two Hellraisers still raising hell. And he looked at me and he said, Gordy. And I said, yep. And we chatted for familiar, you know, things from back when he was CO and XO of 174 for about 10 minutes. And then he was gone. He was out on the world again.
As you watched his career progress, and he became a senator known for independence, bipartisanship, sometimes angering his own party, sometimes angering liberals with the various moves he made and the votes he took. Watched him lose for president twice, once to George Bush, once to Barack Obama. How do you feel his political legacy stands as the nation mourns the passing of this man who really was a unique figure in the Senate in the modern era?
I think the thing I'm going to remember him for him most and whatever was that he would shift gears, that he would look at things and say, yep, I'm a Republican, but that's something that needs to be handled by everybody, not by one thought. And there were other times he was dead set, it's going to be this way and nothing else. From the things that I read and listened to on the media, he did shift gears when he believed that it was to the benefit of everybody. I did not see, and can't say that it didn't happen, but I did not see his real interest in specializing or special favor type events. His focus from my limited vision of it was, this is the United States, and I'm in the service of the United States. And that's my personal feeling.
But that instinct to put country over party has resonated with so many people, I think, that mourn his passing.
Well, if you look at what we're doing today, how many other people do it and should be doing it? And that's what's wrong with our government right now, is we won't get off of our, how much money did I get on this and that? And I know I'm going to get shot when I walk out the door, but that's the way I think I and a lot of other people feel, is that the priority is on how much money am I going to get for this campaign, that campaign, this campaign, and that's got to stop.
Yeah. And it's been remarked upon many times since his passing that so many of his colleagues in the House and Senate were afraid of taking a tough vote, afraid of perhaps defying their base. For John McCain, who'd been through the worst ordeal perhaps you could go through in the military, he'd faced down far greater fears, I guess, and so those political considerations didn't scare him as much.
No, and I think that was something that was not only innate in him, but I think it was also his way of saying, no, there are things that we can do, and I truly believe he felt that way in the later years. In his early years, he was a maverick. In his later years, he was, I think, very focused on the needs of this country.
And so Senator McCain will lie in state in the U.S. Capitol. Actually, today he's going to the Arizona State Capitol. 5 days of memorial tributes in both Phoenix and Washington for John McCain. And, right to the end, he was at odds with the current president, Donald Trump. What are your thoughts about that?
You know, I watched the vote on the Obama things.
The Affordable Care Act.
When he said, no, we're not doing that. We're not getting rid of it. And I think that's one of the few times I stood up and said, attaboy, John, to myself.
And why did you say that?
Because it needed to be said. We were going at it. I don't want to get into politics. That's the worst thing I could do because I'm not the greatest person in all of that. But I thought it was the right thing to do. And there were too many people who really need the medical help. And I don't think we're focusing on that. I think we're focusing on too many other things that aren't as relevant as now as things should be. You know, what are we doing with repairing our roads, getting our nation back into something livable with things we just haven't done for years? And
it will be interesting to see who the governor of Arizona appoints to fill that seat. I know there's been talk that his widow, Cindy McCain, should be considered. What do you think about that?
Have no way to comment on that one. I knew Carol McCain. We used to go out to the beach.
His first wife.
John and Carol would throw big parties out at the beach for the guys and the gals in the squadrons. And so I knew Carol, and I knew how unhappy the Reagans were when they separated.
Why were the Reagans unhappy?
Carol and Mrs. Reagan were close friends.
Nancy Reagan.
We're close friends.
So they were sad to see that marriage end.
Yes. Mm. But it was, if I understand the things that are being said now, that John and Carol actually not long ago got back together and kind of said, okay, it was what it was. But yeah. It was a strange thing to have John with everything in his body broken and Carol to be in the same position almost at the same time and then... You know, from the car wreck she was in. So
that's right. She had been in an accident,
yeah.
Which, you know, so much of this has been lost to time by those that weren't there. And so it's so good to have you come on this program as someone who's been in Jacksonville all these years and can share and bear witness and talk about these reflections because they need to be in the minds of many others.
There's a lot of people who have varying ideas and thoughts of John, as with every other kind of thing we've got going on. This is just the way I felt when I worked with John and subsequently when I found him out in the middle of places that I didn't expect to see him.
What a career for him, and what a career for you in the Navy as well. You know, what an adventure.
If the good Lord said you're 18, what do you want to do? I'd say, send me back to Navy flight school.
And you did it.
I did.
Well, Commander Gordon Law, it is such a pleasure to have you on the show today at this sad time for those that love the man and the leader. Commander Gordon Law, U.S. Navy retired, who served with the late Senator John McCain in the 70s at Jacksonville's own NAS Cecil Field. Good to have you, and thanks so much.
Thank you.
We'll be right back.
The administration says lawsuits by environmentalists are holding up logging projects that could reduce the risk of wildfires. But in the West, there's another, less high-profile culprit.
The biggest enemy of good forest management, especially fire management, is budget cuts.
I'm Ari Shapiro. An ages-old debate over logging gets rekindled this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
In the push for legalization, who has access to the industry?
We've seen it in other states, whereas there wasn't a single person of color who was awarded a license.
Gia Moron talks about cultivating women of color leaders in cannabis. That's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International.
Weekdays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Fresh Air, we continue our series of interviews with Emmy nominees. We'll hear from Scott Frank, writer-director of the Netflix Western series Godless, inspired by classic Westerns, but with some unconventional storylines. It's nominated for 12 Emmys. And Allison Janney, who's nominated for her lead role in the sitcom Mom. Join us today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Can the two Koreas ever become one again? After years of escalating hostilities, there's real talk of a lasting peace on the peninsula. Some family reunifications have begun. Can the countries find a way to end the national divide along the 38th parallel? The Korean Dream. Next time on 1A. Today at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
This Going Green segment is made possible by A1A Solar.
Welcome back. Finally, this hour, you might have heard that Jacksonville's recycling program is actually costing the city money. $2 million or so was spent to ensure that we had a robust recycling program, but only $1.5 million was made on reuse. What's going on here? Well, it has to do with higher standards for recycling, particularly since China raised import standards. They're the largest recycled goods buyer in the world. So how is this affecting our recycling program, and what can we do to make it better? Jason Graves is general manager for Republic Services in Jacksonville, and he's on the line with more in today's Going Green. Hey, Jason.
Good morning, Melissa. How are you?
Great, thanks. And so, as I understand it, recycled goods now must be 99.5% pure to be imported into China. So if there's anything in the recycling bin that makes it impure, batteries or food or whatever, that can cost Jacksonville money. Is that right?
Correct. Our biggest challenges that we have, it stems all around quality. We have seen a lot of material in our stream ranging from, like you said, batteries to diapers, tires, clothing, even parts of animals have been thrown in there, and it's either a lack of education or at sometimes just a bin gets full, so it's just the easy way out when it comes to getting rid of material. And that forces a big challenge on us.
It's challenging because a whole block, a whole neighborhood can do their recycling right, and one messed up bin can ruin the whole batch. That's what you're dealing with, correct?
Correct. Standards have gone from around a 5 to 7% a few years ago, contamination levels, down to, you know, 2%. Could be passable to, like you said, 0.5%, which is very difficult when material comes in a truck, all commingled, goes over a sort line, and we have to try and pull out the contamination. The standards have increased to the point where it's made it very difficult.
Okay, so then what should everybody be doing to make sure that if they're recycling, they're doing it correctly? Give us some tips.
Well, the first thing I have to say is if they have a chance, go to a website called RecyclingSimplified.com. It's this website that Republic Services had put out and put together that gives a lot of information on how to recycle the right way. It's filled with tips, videos, and just general information on the do's and don'ts of recycling. Some of the keys is know what to throw away. We have, and there's four major categories, which is cardboard, paper, metal cans, and plastic bottles. If you keep it to those, you're already on the right start. And saying we use is when in doubt, throw it out. If you're unsure, throw it out. The next would be keep it empty, clean, and dry. And a sign of that is if your recycle bin is clean and dry, then so is your recycling. So you can kind of use almost like a smell test on your recycle bin if you're doing it the right way. And finally, keep it loose. A lot of people, they think it's they're helping by putting all the recyclables together in a plastic bag, tying it up, and then putting that in the recycle bin. Unfortunately, when that truck dumps and that bag comes up a conveyor where people have to sort it, we have to take the time to either rip it apart. And unfortunately, a lot of people will do the same thing with garbage. And if we rip every bag apart, we risk contaminating what potentially was a clean stream. So keep your recyclables loose.
Interesting.
And
I didn't know that.
Those are the three basic steps. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then you mentioned cardboard, paper, cans, and bottles. But not you didn't mention other forms of plastic. Why not?
Well, plastic bags, for example, they can cause a lot of problems within our stream. And again, plastic bags, they are recyclable through the right stream. Take your plastic bags back to a grocery store, and they have a recycling program there most likely. And, like, for example, that's how I get rid of my plastic bags. When it comes to our stream here, they act a lot like paper, so that's a contamination into our clean paper bales that would fail any inspection. The other thing they do is we use screens to separate material, and these plastic bags and things like garden hoses and chains, they wrap up around the shafts and the discs and our pulleys on all our conveyors, and they can take down our entire system. And we have to use, you know, manual labor to go into these screens to try to clean them. So it causes downtime, which, again, is an expense to us trying to maintain, you know, a strong recycle program.
All good information. And again, as Jason said, if you are really committed to recycling the right way and making sure that the recycling actually is successful, just follow those tips at the website, recyclingsimplified.com. And, you know, it's really something that is easy to do, and the city provides the bins, so take advantage of it. And Jason, General Manager for Republic Services of Jacksonville, running one of the largest recycling operations in the city, thanks so much for being with us today. We appreciate your time.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers today. Our producer is Kevin Merchart. Michelle Corum runs the board during the hour. Our theme, composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Next on 1A, how a rollback of rules over coal will impact the economy and the environment. That's coming up next. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. And if you're listening tonight at 8 o'clock, you will hear our rebroadcast. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.